this morning with the sundown shining in.
Where's the money, Lebowski? Where's the f***ing money, head?
It's down there somewhere. Let me take another look.
Found my mind in a brown paper bag, but then...
106 miles to Chicago. We got a full tank of gas, half a pack of cigarettes. It's dark, and we're wearing sunglasses.
Hit it.
Tripped on a cloud and fell 8 miles high. I tore my mind on a jagged sky.
Okay, you know, you guys aren't privy to all the new so, you know... That's what you pay me for.
I just dropped in to see what condition my condition was in.
Illinois Nazis. I hate Illinois Nazis.
Now let's cut through the chase, okay? What are you guys selling?
I lost you $60,000. There is no one who wants to make that money back for you more than I do.
There's just one thing, dude.
What's that?
You have to use so many cuss words.
What are you talking about?
Don't worry, nobody's listening anyway.
I woke up this morning with the sundown shining.
Hello and welcome back to Stacks and Jacks. I'm Hal. Greg Pappas on the board. S&P futures up 47. Yes, 47. NASDAQ futures up 300. It's all because Micron came out and said, by the way, their revenue is going to be 8 point something billion per quarter. Now, last year, it was... for quarter ending May 31st, 2024, was 6.8, an 81% increase year after year. For the 12 months ending May 31st, it was 21. Now the guy's saying it's going to be 32. Make that like 33 or 34. But at 21 billion, that comes out to about we got a billion one. It's like $20 a share in revenue, maybe a little less, maybe like 19. And the stock's trading 111. So if they get up to 8.7, yeah, that's pretty good. I don't know how much of that's going to be just increase in prices, but whatever it is, it's that's what kind of goosed the market here, and we've and the market is up. You know,
also, the government decided to stay open or whatever.
They never close. Well, they have a couple times, but.
What's his name said no omnibus in December, though?
Who?
The speaker.
Johnson.
They always say that. They always say it's the last time. How many last times is this, Lou? 10?
At least 10. Yeah.
This is the last time you ever get away with this. What about next time? Well, maybe next time.
I mean, part of the problem is from my partisan perspective is that the Republicans have a significant number of defectors and
traitors in the midst,
not traitors, defectors, people who they can't impose party unity right now, and if they could, we might be seeing a different deal. But they at the end, it's a hard thing for an individual congressman to say I'm going to take this stand when they know that, or he knows that, he's going to become the focus of a national media circus against him if he takes a stand that locks down or prevents the continuation of the government. And the Republican Party has gotten itself convinced that it can't do that. It can't be seen as the party that shuts down the government, because it'll hurt them. And I just think that's a failure of leadership, and it's been a failure of leadership for a generation, an inability to articulate in just good old fashioned plain English, this is why we're doing what we're doing. Well, this is why we're not going to allow this thing to move forward.
They should start without a buffoon of a presidential candidate that says he's not going to charge taxes to whoever he happens to be talking to.
I would not choose Donald Trump to articulate any position, but at least he can sit down and articulate something as compared to his opponent.
Well, I don't know who can articulate what, but on the one side, you've got a guy running around saying the numbers. Last time I checked, Lou, the numbers are the numbers. they're broke, okay, and they're going from omnibus bill to omnibus bill, and you got one guy running around telling everybody, he's in front of a bunch of waiters, he says, we're not going to tax tips, he's in front of a bunch of other people. He's like the madman Caesar that thinks whoever's in front of him, he can make their life better by being a dictator. And then the other one's running around saying that, oops, nobody can afford a house, well, we'll give everybody $50,000 apiece. I think which one's
the dictator? One actually wants to work within the confines of the constitutional system. The other one's actually worked to destroy the constitutional system.
It's obvious to most, except if you're on extreme one to the other. One is running for God knows what, maybe president, maybe entitlement, we don't know. The other one's trying to run for king. The next 40 days, Lou, listening to both of them speak.
Oh, I know.
The nation's got to become appalled.
It's a terrible choice. I have, as I'm sure the listenership is aware, I have a very clear priority list of things that you don't do and expect me to vote for you. And at the very top is subvert the constitutional system of government that we've had in place. And Harris falls right onto priority number one.
We've been doing it for 20 some years.
No, she hasn't.
I mean, everybody.
We have not had an infirm, incompetent, non-functioning president in the White House until we got Mr. Biden since Wilson, or maybe FDR. And I just hold her accountable for that.
Why is that her fault?
She lied about it. She knew this guy was a non compos mentis. She lied along with the rest of his staff to hide it from the American people.
We got other better stuff to talk about. I've been trying this week with my little bit of training in media relations. Like I said, a little bit. All this stuff that you see that these people are doing, really kind of on both sides, it's right out of the politics playbook.
You can't be serious. You think Donald Trump is responding to media training?
No, Donald he has a pretty good sense of politics, or he wouldn't be there. All these people,
I don't think Donald Trump is trainable.
No, that's where the businessmen, the lawyers, that's where I push back on really everybody on the show. It's you and me to a large extent don't understand the business of politics. They are good at it, both of them. That's why they're here.
I think Trump is intuitively smart, and if you read somebody like Scott Adams or somebody who focuses strictly on persuasion and persuasive conduct, he ranks Trump very high, but I don't think Trump has been trained to do that. I think that is his instinctive stuff. He goes off the rails so regularly.
I'm having difficulty as usual communicating. If he was in front of a group of lawyers, he would be smart enough. When you're in front of a group, I'll repeat a little bit what I said about to Russell yesterday. When you're in front of a group as a politician, you have to be very, very careful. If you ask me a question, I'll repeat what I said yesterday, regarding federal bureaucracy. And I feel the same way about federal bureaucracy as you do. And if I was stupid enough to say, the federal bureaucracy is something that seems like I got out of control. We have duplication in a lot of places. Name one. Name the consumer division that should be done by the Comptroller of Currency. It could be... If I were to give a dissertation that made some sense and said at the end of my term, when I get in, by the way, we might have 10% less people. If there's 100 people in a room, Lou, 98 may agree with me. They're not going to vote. They're not going to change their vote because of what I just said. If two of them are federal employees, they'll never vote for me my entire life. That's the way you have to understand it. If this guy walked into a group of lawyers and he said, you friggin' lawyers, you have no idea how much you help people. If it wasn't for you, if you weren't defending people, if you weren't doing stuff, if you weren't keeping these big corporations away from the little people, you know what? This country would really, really suck more than it does. So I'm going to do it for you guys. By the way, I'm going to put a cap on your income tax because you should be making even more. Well, hopefully 95% of the people believe I'm full of crap. The other five are going to say, I'm voting for them no matter what. These are, I mean, you don't think that Trump got himself votes between the waitstaff of the world by saying he's not going to tax tips? You and I know there's no way on earth that anybody can.
But you don't need special training to do this.
I understand it. They understand. You and I sit there and go, what kind of dumb speech is that? It's not a dumb speech.
Well, okay. So I don't want to run off on this because I think, having listened to you, I think we're probably in some kind of semantic little twist here rather than something substantive. So
all I'm saying is the stupid stuff they say is being done for a reason. And it's a reason we don't get because we keep adding stuff up in our head.
That could well be. I mean, to me, and then I'll leave this topic. To me, the big difference is if you listen to Trump, I think you're getting an authentic assessment. I mean, and I'm not talking about a speech. I'm talking about when he sits down and talks to people in these long form conversations that he has. The perception that he creates, whether, and I think it's real, but the perception he creates is you're listening to him think and, you know, tell you what he thinks in the moment. With Harris, you don't get that. Let me just put it politely. You don't get that. And I think that's a huge part of Trump's appeal. Now, it works both ways. It gives him what I think is an absolute floor of rock solid support somewhere in the probably 35-40% of the voting base of the Republican Party, maybe a little bit less, but that's enough to get him the nomination. But it also gives him, in my opinion, and you just talked about it, a ceiling, which is, you know, maybe 48-50% of the electorate, because the authenticity that he projects is problematic for a huge percentage of the population.
Well, you're talking about somebody who talks, if you listen to him, and boy, I have people close to me, he's the greatest man that ever walked because he's going to do something for me. The man has never done anything for the middle of the lower class his entire life. Except kick people out. I
would disagree with that, but in any event, that's...
Well, I'm not... I'm trying to figure out if I'm voting for you or somebody else on this show. I'm not voting for either one of them. I can't. I'm abhorred of what the next 4 years might bring, no matter who's there.
Let me lead you then into, because as you know, I laugh about our politicians thinking that they can control events because foreign policy is always out there, and I always tell you on this show, listen. We can talk about how we're going to develop the economy and do all these other things, but, you know, Iran, Russia, and China get a vote, whether we like it or not. And one of those votes, potential votes, is coming up. And does the name Bighorn mean anything to you?
It was a Dodge truck, wasn't it?
No, I think that's a Ram.
Well, no, the Bighorns was the big Ram.
If
you went to buy a Dodge truck and you didn't get the Bighorn, you'd have to go back and trade it in once you saw somebody else with the Bighorn.
Maybe that's right. The Bigfoot. I don't know a truck, the Bigfoot.
By the way, I agree with you 100% on this. The only thing is, if we're not strong economically, we don't even get a vote.
The Bighorn is a U.S. naval support ship.
Okay.
It's manned, I think, by civilians, but in any event, it is what's called an oiler. And Carl alluded to this, I think, in one of his emails. But
who are those manned by? Are they merchant marine? What are they?
I would compare them to merchant marine. They're an auxiliary U.S. Navy function. They're like a civilian contractor. We don't have very many of these things, and their specialty, this particular class of ship's specialty, is that it can carry enough aviation fuel and support lubricants to keep an aircraft carrier battle group operational. You know, fly the jets, fly the helicopters, do all the other support stuff that, you know, project power. So we only have a few of these things, which is just totally idiotic.
Lou, sorry to interrupt. Can you give us kind of a view of how they operate? Are they with the battle group all the time, and whenever they can dash off to some port, fill up and come out, or are they dash out from a port and try and catch them at sea somewhere?
Well, they try to catch them. They try to, obviously, they're oilers, so they're out there refueling at sea.
But they're with the group all the time.
They're with the group. They're either with the group or they're getting fuel and bringing it back. So they and you know, I had not seen the numbers until I read an analysis earlier this week about how much aviation fuel a carrier battle group that's engaged in combat operations consumes.
It's gotta be huge.
It's monstrous. I think we have 50 or 60 million gallons of jet fuel in reserve or in storage at any given time that's available for the Navy to draw immediately. So that's aviation fuel, just aviation fuel. That equates to about 16 days of full combat operations with I think three carrier battle groups.
How quickly could you change the combo in some fracking plant to do more aviation fuel than gasoline if you wanted?
Well, it I don't know about fracking, but and doing that. Cracking operation. I don't know, and I don't know what the response would be. But the short answer is, no matter how much we pump out of our limited refinery output, we don't have the capability to store or ship more than what I just mentioned. And so these vessels, we don't have very many of them. And so this one, the Bighorn, is assigned to the Med fleet, and it's chasing a carrier battle group around. And you know, I don't know what the actual cause was, but they ran it aground. The crew ran the ship aground, damaged the keel, damaged the rudder. It can't operate anymore. And so now, this carrier battle group, which is moving into, I believe, into the Red Sea, now does not have a way of getting, you know, in one spot anyway, enough jet fuel to maintain continuous operations.
Hey,
so
Lou,
if the Houthi
is a Navy person in charge of that, or is it a civilian in charge of that one?
It's a contracted vessel, so it's a civilian in charge, but the Navy, or a civilian manning the boat, but the Navy's in charge.
So the Navy gives orders to the civilian ship?
The Navy tells the civilian ship, be here, be there, be, you know, be
Did
here.
They tell them to be in a shallow place?
I don't know. They were presumably going back into a port. I mean, we're just pulling up to the coast to take a look at the rocks.
Well, when
presumably, hold on. Let me answer Greg's question. they were headed in, unless you're an Italian ocean liner captain. Presumably they were headed in or out of port when they ran it aground.
Were there naked girls on the beach like the Italian guy?
I highly doubt it.
All right.
The point is, the loss of this vessel effectively caps, without more, effectively constricts the ability of that aircraft carrier to fly airplanes. And if you can't fly airplanes, that's a very expensive bobber
floating
around there in the ocean.
You got me so curious on this. I'm going to ask you to back up here. If you're in a Red Sea and you and I are running this ship, where the hell do we go to fill up? Diego Garcia or someplace? I mean, you don't just pull into Sudan and fill up on aviation fuel. We have
fuel arrangements with ports all over the world. You may remember the Fat Albert scandal that the Navy was involved in about 10 years ago.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
That was the guy who had cut deals with the Navy and Navy ship captains to provide them with fuel and service support in ports throughout Asia. And he was securing these contracts by basically doing what you just said, Tom, putting naked girls on the beach, except you were allowed to actually go ashore and have fun with these naked girls under his agreement. That's how he was getting the contracts. But yeah, these port arrangements are scattered throughout throughout Africa and Arabia and the Mediterranean. So these ships go in.
There's a place in New Orleans or someplace, I guess what I'm getting to is how tough is it to make this airline fuel? In other words, do we have to ship the stuff to the ports, or can you pull into an Italian port and they have it? It's the same fuel, I guess, as an airliner uses, I guess, my question.
No, not always. No, it's some of it, and it's different fuel. So some of it's helicopter fuel, some of it's jet fuel, some of it is fuel for the actual operation of the vessel itself.
But I mean, so there's probably not, in the Mediterranean, you might have three of these ports. Where do you have one in the Red Sea?
I don't know where they would port it. You know, we would have a contractor or somebody obligated to give us the gas in a facility established somewhere so we could refuel.
I guess I would have to ask, do we have a bigger ship that can supply this thing on the seas if we have to?
No, these are, as I understand it, these things are the biggest, but they're also, you know, again, they have a special capability to transfer the fuel. You don't just, it's not like you just run up and throw a hose over the side and hey, you know, start sucking on one end of it, yeah, to get a siphon established and then pop it into your gas tank.
Sounds like they got five or six different kinds too.
It requires special hoses, special coupling, special capabilities, and this vessel, when this vessel goes aground, we're screwed for until we can get. Now there are other smaller ships that can provide some support to the group, but it's a lot more complicated logistically, and it creates all kinds of problems for that aircraft carrier to try to get this fuel. And this is a lesson that apparently has been lost. People have been screaming about this since the early aughts, about the decrease in our ability to support logistically support our guys in the front lines. And as we know, you know, as we talked about when the Russians first invaded Ukraine, logistics wins wars. You know, the ability to move stuff to the front, to get your people to the spot, you know, all of it arrives roughly the same time or in time for the fight. That's what wins wars. If you are dependent, and if we have gotten ourselves to the point where we are dependent on, you know, a single vessel like this that can be, you know, never mind it running aground, let's just say that somebody decides to torpedo the thing. You know,
that would probably be somebody's first shot if you knew what you were doing.
You are exactly correct. It is the reason why when the Air Force was buying its ill-fated tanker, KC-47 tanker, and that whole debacle, when Airbus came up and said, "This, we can make a plane that will hold, you know, X amount of fuel, which is, you know, 15 to 20% more than the Boeing version, and, you know, it's bigger. You won't have to buy as many of them because it can hold more gas." The Air Force's response was, "We don't need a bigger tanker. We need more of them because we have to disperse them." And we do not want a situation where if you shoot down one of those tankers, and they would be the first targets, if you shoot down one of those tankers, suddenly we can't refuel, you know, like three squadrons. Whereas if you knock down one of the other ones, the slightly smaller, but we have more of them, it only marginally diminishes our refueling capability. The Navy has gotten to the point where the loss of this vessel effectively cripples that carrier battle group.
We have talked, and as long as you've been on, and you've been, I hate saying something nice to you while you're here. I don't mind saying it when you're not here. you've been, you know, leading this thing, and by the way, you have an avid listener and learner in me. Because, you know, I've read nowhere near what you have on the history of warfare, but you're right. The amount of bullets. If you don't mean, and I've read George Marshall, you need the soldier, you need the gun, you need the bullets, you need the toilet paper, you need the food, all in one spot, or you don't get anywhere. And I mean, you and I 100% agree on all that. And it's been somewhat worrisome to me. And I've explained this to you before, and I think you've agreed. Ever since Grenada, ever since Gulf War I, you know, maybe even Gulf War II, we got this feeling that we were so good at this stuff that after a regular war is 30 days max. And you and I have all said, what if it's not that way? If all of a sudden you have to be someplace for a while, now we're in Afghanistan for a while, I don't know what you want to call that, but the idea of us having to, we have less aircraft carriers than we did 20 years ago. Now, they're probably better, but we have less. We have way less supply ships than we had 20 years ago. Maybe we didn't need them all because we knock off everybody in 30 days. It's been real obvious to me, Lou, that when you let that drain out, at some point, I don't know how you and I could have made the claim in front of Congress 15, 18 years ago, we need 15 more of these fleet oilers. They're looking at you like you're from Mars. What do you mean? Every time we have a war, it lasts 4 days. What do we need that stuff for? What do we need? What do we need people hauling more food out to aircraft carriers for? We'll just pull into port for 3 weeks and load the thing up. Lou, you couldn't have made that argument 15 years ago, whatever side of the aisle you were on. But now all of a sudden, hey, how come we don't have this stuff?
Well, you could have, but and people did. Like I said, people have been screaming about this since the early aughts. But the priorities were always somewhere else.
Let's go to quick break and then make it our priority to talk more about it. Lou, it's not the budget deficit, which I talk about all the time. It's not just the deficit. It's stuff like this we're behind on with the deficit.
Exactly. I mean, one of the things, and Robert Gates, who was the Secretary of Defense under both Bush and Obama, pretty smart guy, pretty thoughtful. I've read a bunch of his stuff.
Why can't we get a guy like him run for president?
Well, and yet, in 2000, I think it was 2008, he canceled the buy on the F-22. And we were supposed to have like 500 of those things. He cut the buy at 180, saying it's expense. You know, we don't need stealth fighters in Afghanistan. Blah 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 blah. And I thought at the time, this is idiotic. Who told him to do this, or is he doing it on his own? Because I could see in 2008 that Russia was not interested anymore, having, you know, I'd been working there until, you know, 5 years previous to that. Russia was not interested in any way, shape, or form in limiting its ambitions, and they were pushing in this area, and China had been stealing everything it could get from us with both hands in an effort to build up its defense industrial base, and they hadn't limited their aspirations. If you read the stuff coming out of the Chinese war colleges at that point, the translations, and I just thought, what are we doing? We need those airplanes. We're going to need those airplanes.
Lou, on a numbers basis, you already pissed away at an incredible amount of the money for the F-22 in getting the first 10 up there. Once you get 122, shouldn't the cost per plane be going down dramatically on the next?
It goes. It drops dramatically. And we would have kept the manufacturing lines open. You know, that all that is gone now, Tom. The ability to produce one of those airplanes.
How are we getting parts?
I'm for it.
How are we getting parts?
They kept some capability in terms of storage that we bought. We did an advance buy on parts. I know they're cannibalizing some of the aircraft, but you know, it just.
Well, let's go to a quick break because I'll take a quick story from a small end and how that works. SP Futures up 46, NASDAQ Futures up 302. Yes! Be right back, Stocks and Jocks.
You know, guns don't kill people. Stupid motherfuckers with guns kill people.
Is your business being challenged by the complexities surrounding healthcare reform or other matters related to human resources management? If so, then Cognos HR can help. A longtime friend and contributor to the Stocks and Jocks radio program, Cognos HR provides its clients with a perfect blend of strategic consulting and day-to-day HR management to drive overall improvement in business performance. Companies that join the Cognos HR family are better able to manage healthcare costs, enhance benefit offerings, and improve employee satisfaction by leveraging our access to Fortune 500 benefits. Our innovative onboarding and payroll technology, along with our constant attention to detail, enables us to provide the highest level of quality service to our clients. Now, your time and energy can be focused on generating business and increasing your bottom line. We'll take care of the rest. For more information, call us at 630-401-8810 or search us on the web at CognosHR.com. Cognos HR, innovation in human resources. Licensed in Illinois and Arizona.
Here's the thing. If you can't spot the sucker in your first half hour at the table, then you are the sucker.
Stocks, Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here, right now, right
now. Lord, welcome back to Stocks and Jocks. I'm Tom Howell. Greg Pappas on the board. SP Futures up 46. NASDAQ Futures up 32. Yes, pretty much everybody's up. Meta's up 11. The big mover here is Micron. Boy, we tried to do an earnings thing in there, and I was Greg, this thing has been 150 and it's been 85 in the last, I'm going to say, 7 months. So it is kind of all over the place. The straddle was 950, which is a call on the put. And we try to do an earnings play in there by doing a calendar spread. You know what, Greg? I was so cheap on the thing. I didn't really want it. I thought the straddle was really cheap at $9, and here it is, move 16. I said to my brother, I go, Dan, you know what? We should just buy this straddle. But I'm not normally buying stuff for $9 for my clients. In fact, I'd never do. But guess what? We'd have doubled our money, for God's sake. I mean, that's, why was the straddle so cheap? Anyway,
nice.
Technical term, I guess, but strange stuff. Over in Europe, DAX up 219, 1.1%, FTSE up 15.2%. FTSE's lagging here. GAC around up 114, 1.5. So big move up in Europe, except for the FTSE. Asia, these guys are continuing to pour money, and the idea of these guys, you know, cutting their reserve requirement by 50 basis points and having it be the panacea. Ugh. Nikkei up 1,000 points, that's 2.8. 38,925. Beijing affirms stimulus measures. Stimulus just put more money in. Okay, so that's what they're doing. Hang Seng up 795. That's 19,924. Shanghai up 104. 3,000 exactly. So instead of being 2850 wherever they were, or 2800, they're now back to 3,000. Yesterday we were down just a hair. Dow was down 293. But you can't go by the Dow. S&P futures were down 10. Nasdaq were up 8. So let's say the rest of the market was flat. Bonds. Unchanged, 3.77. The Bund down 5 basis points, 2.14. Japan up 2 basis points, 0.83. Oil's going the other way. One down $1.78, back down to $67.91. Maybe we'll have Greg comment on that somewhere during the show. Brent down $1.81, 71.65. Natural gas up 4 cents, 2.68. RBOB down 3 cents, 1.96. Gold up another $16, 27.01. That's got to be a record. Silver up 85 cents. Man, am I glad we didn't sell anything in silver. We're just long silver. $32.75. Copper up 9 cents, $4.58. We've got the U.S. dollar pretty much the same against the euro, 111.5. The pound is creeping toward 134, though. We're going down against the pound. And Japan is 144. Bitcoin up $1,100, 64,416. Greg, I can't wait for these money supply numbers tomorrow. I get the feeling our money base is going up, 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 up. What do you got for us, Traffic, Weather, Sports? Sox win in 10. I love it.
Morning, everyone. 6:39 here in Chicago. It is 54, sunny to partly cloudy and pleasant. High of 74 today. Phoenix, we got more record-breaking temps. Phoenix is currently 83. And we've got a high of 109. And also, hurricane approaching Florida's panhandle. That will probably be a Category 3 later tonight.
The thing is huge, though.
Yeah, and heavy storm surge up to 15 feet. Yeah, stay tuned. It's probably Tallahassee is directly in line and moves all the way up to over the course of the next couple days.
They're talking Atlanta. 6 inches of snow all the way into like rain all the way into like Tennessee.
Yeah, Atlanta and Asheville, Charlotte, all those. Yeah, it could strengthen more depending on the warmth of the water. So as it approaches Tampa, we'll know. What else? Traffic. Inbound Kennedy from Montrose, 22 minutes. Edens from Lake Cook, 53 minutes. Eisenhower from Wolf, 41 minutes. Inbound Ryan from 95th is 23 minutes. Stevenson from 294 to the Ryan is 31 minutes. NFL tonight's Cowboys-Giants. That's at 7:15 Prime Video.
I don't have Prime, so there's no game for me.
I got to go to the bar. Also, MLB. Cubs lose at Phillies. That was 6-9. Angels lose at White Sox. That was 3-4. Giants lost at Diamondbacks, 2-8. That's all I got, Chief. Back
Lou,
to you.
Lou, you're not a quick break here for sports. You're, I don't know if you're aware of this, the White Sox are about to, well, if they lose one more game, they break the record for losses in a year. And if they lose one more game at home, they break the record for losses at home. So they've got this series here against the Angels. And so the owner decides to have $10 tickets, $5 parking, and $5 beers or something. So the place gets kind of packed the first night with everybody dying for him to lose, and sell the team, and they suck, all that kind of stuff. So the Sox rally for 3 runs in the bottom of the 8th, and they win. So they do the same thing again last night. last night the Sox pulled out in 10. So not only do these grave dancers have to sit there all night long, of course, by now they're probably trashed. But the Sox are wooden late, so if the Sox win again tonight, there's three nights of grave dancers going home disappointed. Do you believe that?
I do. And I guess he's looking to expand the fan experience. I mean, the Rockies are here for their last homestand, and I'm seeing more people in the street. Our offices are not too far from the stadium, and I can see, you know, a lot more people going in the streets than you would normally see for a lousy baseball game. And so people saying, well, you know, let's catch it at the end. And Charlie, what's his face? I just dumped his last name. The bearded outfielder who's played his entire career here and is at his prime was a very good baseball player, is retiring. And so I think people are coming in to watch the last hurrah. And then my conference, you know, that Air Force plays in, the Mountain West, is so speaking of sports and getting our sports licks in, is in the news for two reasons. The first is the conference is exploding. Blowing, by that I mean, or maybe imploding is the right term, as teams abandon it to go to the Pac-10. And then the UNLV starting quarterback, a kid who has looked pretty good, and has led them to three victories in the first time that school has been ranked in the top 25, sent a message out Tuesday night saying, because I certain representations that were made to me have not been fulfilled, I am going to take this as my redshirt year, and I'm not going to play anymore. I'm sitting myself down. And took himself off the roster.
Lou, your name was bandied about by me as why weren't you here when we need you in the bar last night when we met a couple of my trader buddies. What are the nature of these contracts?
This comes at a great time. I mean, if you're the plaintiff's counsel in that big antitrust case that is being settled right now, the proposal is actually due in court today. The judge basically didn't reject the entire initial proposal for settling the case for detailing the damages, but she sent them back to tweak certain portions of it. So that report is due today, so the timing of this kid saying I'm not going to play for this team is great. This was an oral promise that was made. By the way, one of my headaches, and I realize we're getting sloppier with our language, but I heard, you know, yet another sportscaster who should know better, a journalist, say it was a verbal contract, and my response is, of course it's verbal, you ninny. You can't have an agreement without words. It's an oral contract, is what he meant to say, which is it's not written down. An oral contract that was apparently established by one of the assistant coaches, who said, we will arrange to get you $100,000. And remember, this is this kid's last year. We're going to get you $100,000 for an NIL.
From an auto dealer or someplace that they're going to find for him.
Well, yeah. I mean, they were going to make arrangements for it. He's apparently been paid $3,000. So Vegas, UNLV, has a sports collective group that operates outside the aegis of the university. This is really interesting to me because, of course, back in the day, you couldn't, if you were an agent, a sports agent, you could not talk to a kid in any detail at all while they still had any eligibility left.
So what are they calling themselves now, marketing people?
This guy refers to himself as an agent, and
really?
he's with an entity. So the kid, the assistant coach at UNLV makes an oral promise, this is the kid's version, saying, we're going to get you $100,000 in NIL. The kid is, by the way, has had three terrific years at Holy Cross. So you have a situation where football coaches are going out to other teams and, you know, poaching. Deion Sanders did this.
Well, allegedly they can't do that till a guy puts himself in the portal. Allegedly.
Allegedly. Tell that to CU here, where they've recruited most of their team that way. This kid gets poached. This is the arrangement. Come play for us.
Expand on that for a second. If I keep using this example of Notre Dame with the last guy last year, Hartman, who is got money from Under Armour, who just happens to be. Now, what if, and he was at Vanderbilt, I think.
He was at Vandy.
What if Under Armour calls him and says, you know, the Irish are looking for a quarterback. You look like you got your eligibility left. You look like you want to play. You're not going high in the draft, but maybe you could after one more year. How about we sign you an Under Armour contract, and by the way, you go to Notre Dame? Is that they're not an agent? What are they? Are they legal? Does anybody know? What exactly is that going on?
Well, so technically, you know, this is the arrangement would be we have sponsorship agreements with Under Armour. If you come play for us, those sponsorship agreements will produce X amount of money.
So you think the Notre Dame coaches made the first move? Or his agent called Notre Dame? Or who do you think made the first call, I guess, is my question. I'm hugely curious on this.
Oh, I think somebody contacted the kid or the kid's parents or the kid's friends and then came to him and said, you can move to this other place and it'll be pretty lucrative. That's how this would work. And the kid goes, okay, I need an agent. So he goes, reaches out to the sports agent group. The sports agent then comes in, talks to the team rep, whoever it is. It was the offensive coordinator, supposedly. Talks to the team rep. They get some kind of an arrangement made. The problem here, is apparently the kid and his family, the school is his name, thought that the UNLV people were acting in good faith. And so they operated on a handshake deal, and this offer was made. The kid comes to UNLV, and a huge part of this is the fault of the school. I put this on the school. If their agent, this offensive coordinator, made this representation to the kid, and he moves, and then the kid delivers, and he's delivering big time for them, The head coach is taking the position now that, well, this, you know, the deal wasn't made with me, so I don't consider us to be bound by it. And I'm going, okay, well, say goodbye to your football program, you know.
Happens if it's the car dealer and all of a sudden he has a bad month selling cars and he says, screw it, I'm not paying?
That may or may not have happened, but no, I'm just saying those are
the kind of guys that are going for the money, right?
That's right, but I'm saying what is happening right now is a circumstance that if I was the school, I would have been saying, okay, we gotta figure out how to make this work. But they're not doing that. They're saying, no, we didn't have that arrangement. The kid was paid $3,000 by the collective for some kind of marketing opportunity, and that's all. And they had been raising the issue with the school.
He's 97 grand short in his mind.
Let's get this in writing. Let's get this reduced to writing so everybody knows what everybody else is doing, and the school balked. And so the kid said, fine, I can play three games. I've played three games. I'm going to take myself out, so there's no question that I still have my redshirt eligibility. This is my redshirt year, and I'll play next year somewhere else.
Has any school ever signed anything like that yet, do you know?
So what I listened to last night, because I was prepping for this interview, I listened to last night were four or five reporters and analysts who have dealt with this, and in some cases they are reducing it to writing, but there's no requirement that they do, and they're nervous about reducing it to writing.
Well, I would
because
be.
You know, yeah. You're not. This is not supposed to happen in the recruiting area. You're not supposed to be recruiting people doing this. So if you have a contract that is dated, signed and dated, you know, before the kid steps on campus, then you potentially have an NCAA violation, and nobody wants to do that. It's one of these weird situations, Tom, where the incentives that are in place actually work against writing, getting a written agreement up front, and work against transparency, you know, in terms of what the expectations are, which is, of course, a disaster in contract law.
Kind of moving towards the Michigan State case, again, you're the gospel on this. That's why I'm asking you. The NIL thing, if I was a talented actor in college and I wanted to do a play 15 years ago and the school told me I couldn't do it, I would feel fairly comfortable saying, based on a Supreme Court decision, you basically screwed me. Now, whether I'd win or not, if I had you as my attorney, I probably would. But this other idea, these guys voting for all this other stuff, $50,000 to be on the offensive line now, that isn't really part of that, in my opinion, part of that Supreme Court decision. How do I go back and say I should have been paid that 15 years ago? Where does that have a leg to stand on? Well, the NIL is something I tried to do on my own, and you stopped me.
Yeah, that's kind of the Reggie Bush situation. But you know, he's coming back after after SC, Southern Cal, for marketing off his name, image, and likeness. So you have a couple of different issues there. The first one is obviously the statute of limitations. How long ago did this happen? Is there a contract in place? Is there some kind of duty or obligation that attached back then? If there is, and I mean, even in places that I think that the statute is unreasonable, like Illinois, where I think it's 6 years, you know, a lot of these claims I think are going to be time barred if you go back that far. One of the issues that they're trying to resolve on this case that I mentioned earlier, the NIL antitrust case, one of the things that I'm trying to they're trying to resolve is how much of a pool they're going to have and how big it is to pay people who are in the, you know, were affected by this, you know, 5, 6, 7 years ago. And I think there's a lawsuit that's been filed against, I think it involved Northwestern, but in any event, a lawsuit that's been filed, you know, another lawsuit on behalf of athletes who were, you know, NC2A people, but who had only very limited scholarship opportunities because they were non-revenue sports.
Well, so the reason why I asked the question is John's brother and a friend of mine who unfortunately died of MLS, ALS. He was a opposite linebacker to Ron Rivera and the Cal way back in the day. And Paul was actually acting. He wanted to get the stunt guys union, and he had an offer from, you know, like Kohl's or somebody for like, you know, $1,000 or something to model flannel shirts in the summer, you know, not with his Cal Bear hat on or anything like that, just because he's a good looking guy, and they told him you can't do it. Now I could see him, even though it was so many years ago, I get him saying, hey, you screwed me out of $1,000. But I don't see how he can go back and say linebackers should have gotten paid 40 years ago. You owe me dough. I mean, one is, to me, a clear
yes
violation of what the Supreme Court said. The other, that's hocus pocus, in my opinion.
I think that's right. I don't see an easy path to valuation. I don't see an easy path to recovery. And of course, the first thing a court's going to look at is, okay, was there an obligation to pay? And you know, well, you know, they were making all this money off me. Of course, there's an obligation to pay. A court may look at that and say, yeah, I'm not so sure about that. And then the second thing is, well, how do we value this? You know, maybe you've been damaged, but if I can't value it and we can't figure out a way to put some money value on it, then you don't have a case. And so these are the things that are going to be roiling out in these, you know, I was an athlete 5 years ago and I didn't get any money and now they're getting money kind of litigation.
And then look at some big fat lineman and say, well, by the way, were you a movie star? Well, not exactly.
Well, right. And so one of the things that you see in the plan that's being considered right now by the court in this antitrust case is something looks sort of like the NFL, where you have a capped amount of money that is available to be distributed to athletes at the school. And this cap will be based on the revenue of an average of power conference school revenues. I think it's 22%. And that number, right now, that number is expected to be somewhere in the, I think it's the $20 to $25 million range per school. And then there will be a monitoring entity set up that will look at whether you are accounting for the money that you're paying to athletes first, and then second, was it done properly? You know, was it done for a legitimate purpose? And then third, have you busted the cap? If you haven't made it for, if you haven't followed the rules on any of those three big items, then the overseeing entity can come in and adjust penalties, whether it's eligibility or it's cap reduction. I mean, I think given the way the legal process works, this is going to be one of those, you know, horses well gone by the time the barn door is closed. So I think the penalties that they're going to be assessing that will have the most meaning to a school is we're going to reduce your cap amount. So if you have an athlete, for example, who is not getting compensated properly, for example, just being given money, play to pay, which is improper. If you have that, we come in and we say, okay, you gave this kid, you know, $800,000 or $900,000. We're going to reduce your cap by three times that amount, well, something like that. Hey, anyway, that's the discussion going on.
We have a minute or two left. I want to give you a quick. We talked about the F-22, and I know we're kind of skipping, but that's okay. I was a finance manager of Pullman's MBTA contract, right? 60 push-pull cars. And halfway through the thing, my boss, one of the engineers, says to me, hey, Tom, find out what these guys want in terms of spare parts. So I went to a couple of the engineers in our place and, you know, did my due diligence. I said, here's my suggested list for you guys. I mean, if it's ever in a crack-up, these, you know, you need stuff for the end of the train and blah, blah, blah. You need a couple end caps. You need this. You need that. I sent them a list of about 50 things with prices that were fair because the line was still running. Never got back to me. I'm calling. In those days, you call people. You didn't send them an email. Calling them, we don't know if we need any. We don't think we need any, blah, 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 blah. So I said, you know, finally I gave them the final warning. Hey, look, you know, we need the spot in the factory for this, that, and the other thing for the next contract, which, of course, we never got. You got to, like, this date. We don't need it. We'll let you know. Quit bugging us. All right, finally, what do you suppose happens 2 weeks after we tear the place apart? We get this list of stuff they need. And they go, you got to price it for me. And I go to the plant, Lou, and I go, how do you price it? The guy goes, you can't price it. He opens the side door to place. He goes, there's the tooling. It's out behind the place rusting. And, you know, I actually was one of the bleeps who said, you know, if you want a toilet, it's $2,000. You know, I mean, and we were going to lose money at that price. I don't know what we had to do to go back to the vendor, and he had to put the thing back together and make one by hand. It was an absolute fiasco if you don't plan this stuff. And I can't imagine something like the F-22. I'll bet they had already ordered a lot of those parts.
They have a depot for repair and maintenance work. So that was in the contract. And they did, you know, a lot of the parts, for example, some of the engines, I mean, they're not unique to the F-22. So they've got capability for that. But you know, the idea that you would shut down that production line with roughly a third of the aircraft that you intended to buy, on the idea that, well, we're not going to really need these again, when every sign, and I'm not a DOD analyst, I don't have the intel they do, every sign pointed to the fact that we were going to need those aircraft desperately, and we do. We need them right now, and we don't have enough.
So what are,
now the
so
F-35, what are we replacing the F-35 with? The F-35 is the quote-unquote replacement, but the F-35 does not do what the F-22 does, and the F-35 is a very capable aircraft for what it was designed to do, but the 22, you know, the 22 is designed for a specific mission that is very important.
It is. It's the cat's meow planes, isn't it? 22.
It's designed. It's designed with maneuverability and stealth. It's designed to get into dogfights if it has to. But what it's really designed to do is to penetrate deeply ahead of any kind of strike force internally with enough weapons internally to do some real damage, and then get out again. You know, the 35 relies on its limited weapons bay and the weapons that other people can shoot. The 35 is designed to be a node, an airborne node, and it's very good at that. And it does stuff the 22 can't do. But if at the tip of the spear, if you've got to engage the bad guys head to head, the 22 is the airplane you want.
Is any of the other stuff still in production? The 15s, 16s, 18s?
We're still producing 15s. The Air Force ordered, Congress ordered. I don't know if the Air Force was all fired up about it. Something called the F-15 EX, which is being produced out of St. Louis, and is like a super F-15. With modern upgrades. It's the only problem is it's visible on radar, but it has the capability to be something called a missile truck, which is you can load 15, 16 air-to-air missiles on that thing.
Which is the one that's really the air-to-air combat one that nobody can still beat? Is it the 16 or one?
I mean, the 15 was that, but because it's a fourth generation aircraft, it's visible on radar, and that's a problem. And of course, we're outranged, as I think I mentioned earlier. We are outranged in our missile capability by both the Russians and the Chinese.
Hey, one final thing. How much of that Boeing Airbus thing was total politics? It had to be 90%. I remember we were doing the show, and every single time Airbus would win, they'd go, wait a minute, we're redoing the contract.
They tossed the Air Force official who was responsible for the buy. They put her in jail. You know, I mean, when you say politics, it was all improper influence and undue influence and the whole thing.
Unbelievable. Well, Lou, have a good weekend, buddy.
You too.
Talk at you next week. SP futures up 42, Nasdaq futures up 285. Lou, if you're long the market, you're happy. Who cares if the rest of the world's falling apart? You're rich. Just saying. Be right back, Stocks and Jocks.
This self-directed trading is a lonely job. Online trading is not as easy as point and click.
No, it's not. Everyone, even professionals, need to share ideas and think out loud every now and then.
That's what I like about PTI Pro Direct. Their staff of former option floor traders really helps me choose the right strategy for trading option volatility and plan the time decay for my covered writing program.
Yep, nothing can replace years of trading experience to stop you from making that dumb trade and for saving a few bucks. We've all been there and done that.
Yeah, I have access to all that great trading advice and experience for just a penny a share for stocks, $1 for equity options, and $1 minimum a trade.
Our clients at PTI Pro Direct can call when they need a little help on a trade or just to talk about the market in general. We trade every day. We love this stuff.
That's what I like most about PTI Pro Direct. Cheap prices along with great advice from real floor traders. It's the best of both worlds.
Tell your friends. That's PTIProDirect.com. PTIProDirect.com.
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now. Right here, right now.
Welcome back to Stocks and Jocks. I'm Tom Howe. Greg Pappas on the board. Taking care of business. Our buddy Dan Janitis is with us, and he's been out there buy, borrow, credit card, advance, into your account, buy. And he's happy as a clam. On high tide, or is it low tide? What is it? High tide or low tide? The clam. I don't know. One of the two.
It's low tide for the clam. All absolutely. Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't think high tide is good for the clam.
No, it's definitely low tide for the clam. We used to go clam digging as kids, you know, in Boston. So that was a popular activity. But yeah, definitely low tide.
Did you ever get any?
Oh, absolutely. Oh, yeah. Right. We'd bring them home. My mother would make clam chowder. And oh, absolutely. Yeah.
How could you tell if they're any good? They just in the seam and you dig them up and throw them in a bag?
You dig them up. There's like a little blowhole and you can tell where they are and you just dig. Yeah. It was a fun thing to do as a kid.
I love clam chowder, so I like linguine with clam sauce, too.
Oh, yeah. The clams are great.
Are you out of the way of this hurricane, I hope?
Yes. Yes, and I'm actually on the West Coast, meaning California at the moment. But we did have, there was mandatory evacuation in Punta Gorda. You know, this time of year, I like to spend as much time away from Florida as I can. So I'm, yes. But it's, you know, it's just heavy wind and rain. I don't think they're going to get hit too bad. I think the panhandle is going to get the worst.
Well, when you, and I am no meteorologist. We need one of Russell's daughters, but When you talk about a hurricane being category 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, you can be a 5. What was the one that was the most intense? Was it Camille? It was a guy's name.
Andrew.
But one was, it was so intense, but it was actually very small, relatively small in terms of area. Some might be a 3, and I think could be 500 miles wide where everybody gets affected. I mean, in terms of rain and everything else. There's massive difference in the size of the storm, even though the intensity, which is the 3, 4, 5 part, could be, you know, more. The barometric pressure in the middle, the lowest barometric pressure, was it McCamille? One of them. That's how you can tell how intense the inside is by the barometric pressure, right?
Camille was in 69. Michael was the latest.
Yeah, well, 2 years ago, we got a direct hit in Punta Gorda, and it was actually our anniversary is coming up on the 28th.
Hurricane Ian was a 5.
Ian, it was a 5, but it had a direct hit to Punta Gorda, where my house it came right over the area where we were. So, and that wasn't a wide storm that hit a relatively small part of Southwest Florida, and it certainly, I mean, it got a lot of attention initially, but the aftermath was pretty terrific, pretty horrific. That lasted for a while, but there's other storms. Andrew was a big one back in '92 that hit South Florida. That, you know, Homestead, Miami, that area got.
Oh, God, I remember that. Homestead was just leveled.
Yeah, that was totally leveled, and that took years and years to replace. But you're right. Most of them are end up being tropical storms.
Oh,
but this particular,
I was mistaken.
One, Helene, is actually, it did require mandatory evacuation, in parts of. Mostly on the west coast of Florida.
Yeah, but it's whipping up the whole coast, like all the way up, even though it's kind of... I mean, the thing takes up the whole Gulf damn near.
It does, and it's more of the storms have been hitting the Gulf than the east coast. The South Florida has not been hit as badly over the past few years. In fact, and this year has been relatively light to only be on an H. I think they mentioned Isaac coming, but to only be on an H with Lean, and it's already late September.
Well, it's been
but
a
there
few
is
that
another
just...
month. I was talking to a client who's there, and there is another month, and he says, oh, it's just about over. And I'm like, well, I know there's been some storms in late October that have hit pretty hard. So that we're not quite out of the woods there.
Well, they've had a few just sneak right up the Atlantic. There's one out there now. There's one that's like, look like it's heading for Britain, for God's sake.
Isaac is the next one that's coming. So, I mean, it's the first one. There's always a lot of hype. You know, everybody batters down and gets all their, you know, their batteries and their water and gets prepared for it. And, you know, by the time you get to September, you know, it's okay. What's coming this week? You know, but this year has been, you know, Florida's been spared somewhat, and I think it's going to go up. It is going to hit the panhandle probably the worst.
Well, Dan, it appears that being led by China, and I just, every day I get more and more pissed off that I'm not getting these money supply numbers, and I know other people are. I have to believe that ever since the Fed speech and China doing what they're doing, the amount of stimulus putting in the world economy is right back on, you know, it's almost back on COVID track, for God's sake. And, I mean, this doesn't happen in gold and in... the markets, right, and stuff, unless something like that's happening, I don't think. But again, we've talked how many times about the market being wrong, pricing these earnings things. Last night, and I've got Micron, you know, 1.75 times the straddle again. I don't think I can ever remember in my bazillion years here where for an entire year, I would wager, just Russell probably has guys that could do this research, I'll bet if you took the top 150 stocks the last four earnings periods, that if you bought the straddle, what would that be, 600 times, that you're ahead. And I can't imagine any year other than this year, maybe last year, where that would have been true. And something's just weird.
Yeah, I think a lot of it has to do with the money that just keeps getting pumped in. So think about you know, the people who made money in tech and in the market in general, well, they're flush with money still, and that it's like the snowball effect. That money keeps getting reinvested. For the most part, people who have money, funds that have money, they reinvest it. So if you're making money in tech, which is what a lot of people have made money over the last few years, it's a snowball effect, and it keeps going. And again, you've mentioned that, you know, the dispersity of wealth, and but there is still a lot of wealth out there, and it's concentrated in certain areas, you know, in certain parts of the country, but also in certain areas where people have been invested in you know, the tech market. What is changing, Chief, though, that I think is important to note, is that the tech companies themselves, their structure is changing. As we've talked before, biotech has already peaked and is already coming off that. And biotech is only a small portion of technology, but it is that cycle is already turned. Technology, I think the part that still people are excited about is AI. But to me, that's still very uncertain. That really hasn't proven itself. And I was with an old Boston friend last night who just got an EV, and we were talking about the EV market and the hype that had. And I use that as an example because we're not quite there yet either. I think hybrids make a lot of sense, but I think EVs were, you know, they're expensive. There's a cost, you know, there's definitely a cost prohibitive, it's cost prohibitive to a lot of people. And it may, you know, we may get there eventually, but for right now, I think there's, you know, we have to kind of get through this. You have to kind of allow tech to do its thing. And I tend to like industries that are proven, where there's operational history, where there's a good management team. And we're getting ahead of ourselves, is my belief, still with technology. But the people who have made money keep putting more money back in. And that's exactly what's happened. Somebody had mentioned to me the other day, and it was really a woman who I would not have expected to have had this insight. And she said, it's been a do-it-yourselfers market. Somebody's making money. She says, it seems like everybody's making money. And they think they can do it themselves. So they put more money back into it. And I think that's what's fueled this acceleration in technology, this acceleration in the market in general. They are overvalued, and there's no question there's a lot of hope down the road. But if you look at most good investments over time, there's going to be, there has to be something to me to be more substantive in order to make that investment. And we're still speculating here with AI. There are a lot of great, it has a lot of great uses. It's proven to be very good in certain areas. But I do think, and I like that people get excited about it, but when you're putting all your money into one or just a few stocks, you really, I mean, besides the fact you're not diversifying, you're also betting. And for guys my age, for people in our age group, people who are close to retirement or retiring, you don't want to do this at this part of your career. So if you're missing out of that last 10%, don't feel bad. I think I would rather be, you know, protect my portfolio at this point, continue to have protection. Fixed income is a no-brainer right now because rates are coming down, so our markets are doing extremely well. And I think, as you're mentioning, with any type of option strategy where you're providing protection, good to have that right now.
Dan, this is kind of a math question. Maybe I'll torment Hal with this next Tuesday. You mentioned some industries, and obviously my brother has some clients that were really into the electric stuff, and they were in the electric cars, and there's industries that seemingly have trouble getting out of their own way. Yet, I guess I want you to, if you can, because I'm having trouble doing it, can you separate the difference between AI, people like Microsoft might make money at AI, even though they haven't made any yet, NVIDIA, you know, they got their shtick going. And the fact that those four or five or six or seven stocks are now 50% of the market. Does it even matter if NVIDIA is a manure company at this point? Once you reach that size, I mean, I've got last few weeks some clients that have come in mostly with concentration issues. But if they let some of the concentration stuff go, they obviously want to diversify, and and we're going to be buying for them. You know, maybe we'll stay away from the Qs because I think they're a little too high, but although I wish I had them today. But by and large, I'm going to be buying those stocks. I mean, the stocks you're talking about, like even some of the biotech, they're kind of not big enough to be in. In other words, how much of Microsoft's going up and the other one's not going up as fast or maybe even going down is because a bunch of guys like me just trying to diversify are putting 50% of my clients' money in those five stocks. I mean, I'm the cause of it. I don't, you know.
If you're tracking the benchmark, I mean, if you're trying to get exposure just following the benchmark and you're talking about 50% of some of the indices being in these six or seven names, then you have to have a certain amount of exposure there. However, if you're looking for risk control, you want to be diversified. So you don't necessarily want to equal weight the index. But where a lot of the money has gone, Chief, is not just into these individual stocks. It's not people saying, okay, we'll buy these five. It's gone into the ETFs.
Right, right.
Use the QQQs and a number of the ETFs. And what happens when people put money in is when they take it out, it affects all the stocks in those ETFs.
Well, it's going to affect those five worse.
So it's the entire sector, if you will, and not just those five names that are going to all go down when the state of Illinois decides that they're going to sell, you know, their tech fund, or they're going to lighten their exposure because this is what a lot of institutional managers will do, because this is what I've done most of my career. They're going to rebalance. So they're going to lighten up in certain areas. They're going to look at the amount of risk they're taking, because we do risk control and we see where our risk is being taken. So they will naturally lighten up. Now, if they're just not lighten up in those five tech names, that's one thing. But what they're generally lighten up is exposure to the entire industry. So all of the other names will trade down in sympathy, or you'll see a sell-off in the whole sector because people have chosen to be in the ETF or into funds that focus on technology that have a large exposure to those five names.
Well,
there's a difference between equal-weighted and market-weighted.
Oh,
and
God,
there's
yes.
a difference. Yeah, and I think that's important for the listeners to know that just having exposure to each of those names, you know, wanting to say, okay, I don't want to miss the upside, that's fine as long as you've diversified into other things as well, that you have exposure to utilities and energy and some other sectors as well. If you start putting money just into those five names and have the stock specific risk that we're talking about, when things turn, you're gonna get hit really bad.
Well, you're only getting rid of half of it if you go into Qs.
Yes, but that's still a big portion of it, right?
Well, but I guess where I'm going with this is that in 2000, again, this isn't 2000, so
right.
You know, but the five stocks were what? Cisco, Oracle, Dell, Microsoft, Intel. Those were the five. Might have been one more in there. And one was we had a lot of people who were in Cisco. A lot of clients at the time, and it was talked about all day long, almost like Apple right now. All of a sudden, the Qs got to like 120. They were the new. The first ETF was the Spider, the S&P 500, and then that's all we traded for our protected index program, because that was all that was there. And then all of a sudden, the Qs come out and it's hotter, right? It's the 100 biggest stock, NASDAQ stocks.
NASDAQ,
so
it's
your S&P was the Buick, and the other one was the Pontiac GTO, right? The Qs. So people pile in there, and exactly happened then is what happened now. Cisco's trading 66. People pour money into Qs. We had all kinds of people that shifted from the Spider to the Qs because they were hotter. We had the put, so we were okay. But the all kinds of people. What do I want to be in Grandpa's S&P 500 for when his Q thing's out there, and these are the stocks that are really moving? And it was, and you start talking yourself into a value of Cisco's trading $65. Well, hell, it just like today, Dan, where we try and think up a reason why Cisco should be $65. That's the future. That's everything. Blah, blah, blah. You can't fight the market. You know, if it's worth it, you know, If it's trading there, it's worth it. Don't even try and, you know, the exact same crap that you hear today about this 5 or 6 or 7. All day long, we're thinking up reasons why the stock needed to be $65. The fact is, every time we bought the Qs, we're buying Cisco. And we could care less, you know, to be honest, I mean, the Qs, I never, maybe more than most, I would say, gee, what exactly is in there and what's the value of this stuff? But I never, and all of a sudden, the thing craps out the Qs from 100, 120 to where? Like 20 or 22 or something? Went down by like 80%. Now here's Cisco trading 650. And I'm starting looking at the numbers and I go, how the hell did this stock ever trade $65? Because, you know, I was an OEX trader. I didn't do fundamental stuff on stock. You probably were much closer to it at the time. I'm sitting there going, I pity the pool that paid $65 for this thing. Now, you're not going to say that in front of a lecture when people in there all had it, right? But by and large, this can get, I mean, if ever something crazy happens, and I sure as hell hope it doesn't, and the Qs, for whatever reason, you know, there's some China default or something that causes the market to fly down, there's going to be somebody that says, how the hell did this Microsoft ever trade 434 at that size?
Right. Yeah. And that's exactly what's happened.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the situation that we're in right now. There's the fear of missing out is still there. So there's still a lot of positive momentum. As we sit today, there's not anything that we can see that's going to disrupt this rally, that's going to disrupt this continue. However, my view on what's happening is that we've seen volatility. So, for example, I mean, yesterday the market was down. Today, the futures are up. But that, if you're willing to stomach that volatility, I do think there's still money to be made. However, I think once the dust settles after the election, people are going to start focusing on things like deficit, things like a statistic came out yesterday that we are at a record high for defaults on auto loans. We're going to be at a record high for defaults on credit card loans soon too. So these things are creeping up, but they're not in the press right now because they're, you know, there's a protection against everything that's going on with the election. There's so much focus on the election that it's really taken over some of the basic economic issues of concern. And the other thing that I think is even more important are people who aren't in our industry that don't have our background, that haven't really had money during 87, during, you know, the late 90s with the dot-com crisis, during the, you know, 03 with the peso crisis. I mean, they haven't been, or 08 even. Many people who were in the market now did not have money to put in the market, or a lot of money to put in the market back in 08 when we had the big correction, the subprime loan issue. So I think what's happened, as I view it, is that a lot of individual investors have gotten somewhat cocky about the market and have said, hey, I can do this. I can do this because I keep making money. Well, I don't need an advisor. I don't need, you know, I'm making money sticking to my own thing. Well, yeah, that's fine. Except the problem is they don't have the perspective to step back and see there will be a period of time that there'll be a correction. They don't understand or talk about the rationale behind why we're seeing this runaway market, and especially in tech. So there's that I think could be the thing that causes the biggest problem here. It's not being led by institutions. Institutions still have risk controls. There's still institutional investors are still being cautious about over-investing in certain sectors of the market. It's really the individuals who have made this money, who have retired, the baby boomers, who now have some time to play with stocks, as they say, or to follow the market, and they just, you know, their egos keep getting gratified as their market values continue to go up, and they think, oh, this is easy. I found a new hobby. That's going to change.
Just like 1929.
Yes, exactly. Precisely. That is 1929. And what? We're getting close to 100 years since then. So history maybe doesn't always repeat itself, but it rhymes.
But our guys, our government, is so much better at it this time than they were in 29.
Yes, that's very true. Because I think there have been certain things we've learned from prior, and I think companies have as well. I think the well-run companies have learned from the period in the late 80s when we had too much leverage. So even though individuals have a lot of credit, and they racked up credit cards and auto loans and mortgages. Companies have been much smarter about their balance sheets, and that's the reason we have not seen.
But as you've many given, you've given banks, you, the citizenry, you and I, and the listeners, have given banks so much money, and we've given them the ability to charge people 23%, 25%, and 30%
yes.
when they're paying people 0.5%. They have the ability to absorb. And everybody thinks this is economic health. I don't think it is. They have the ability to absorb. I mean, if you lose 1 out of 6 people and they're paying 30%, you're okay. Right?
Right. They're better capitalized. The banks are better capitalized. A lot of companies are better capitalized now, so that that risk is. They're managing that risk. They've been managing that risk for the last few decades. So we're not in that same situation that we were in the late 80s, where, you know, everybody leveraged and everybody, you know, leverage was the way to grow. You know, you were growing through increasing the amount of debt you had, basically. And that's when my area, the high yield bonds or junk bonds, as they were referred to, became very popular. But the positive about the high-yield bonds and the junk bonds is that they expanded our economy. They gave a lot of people jobs. It allowed a lot of people who weren't working or a lot of companies that couldn't have flourished an opportunity. And those companies that did it, that grew without greed, the ones that grew slowly and with a vision and a strategic plan, ended up weathering that period. But a lot of companies didn't. This environment we're in, I don't think it's going to help. I don't think it's going to be corporations that have the issue as much as individuals.
Well,
it's going to be the household level and the government level, right?
And we don't care about it. We don't care about individuals. But Dan, and when you talk about junk bonds, we've got a couple of minutes. We'll probably go to break and maybe talk about more afterward, because that's before junk bonds, not non-investment grade bonds.
Non-investment grade.
If a company wanted to finance something, either went to Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley and got basically his pants dropped and got stuck where the sun don't shine, or he went to a bank that did their best to screw the hell out of you too if you're a growing business, or what was the guy's name? The guy with the bad toupee that went to jail? That was his name? Michael Milken.
Milken, yeah.
He invented essentially a third way. And I'm going to say people are concerned about how the government's going after Trump. The government went after this guy because he found another way. He said, you know what? I'm going to put together these things called junk bonds. Well, he didn't name them junk bonds. Non-investment grade bonds, but I'm going to package them for people. Instead of paying 7% or 8%, these things are going to pay 10 or 11. It wasn't 30, and it wasn't 28 like a credit card. So, and he essentially sold those in a packages with the idea of if less than 1 in 10 went under, you were ahead of the game. Or at least even
right.
with the game. And
looking at default risk, that's exactly the biggest risk with high yield bonds is default risk.
And his
minimizing default risk. But we're in an environment right now where the risk of default is very low because companies are much better capitalized, and because for the few defaults we've had, there have been people who have, there have been organizations or private equity firms or hedge funds that have stepped in to purchase these organizations that are distressed. But there's been very few. And my point is that I think is an important point for the listeners, that it's less likely to happen on the corporate side, much more likely to happen on the individual or household side, as well as the government side. So the three areas when you're looking at our, you know, economically, you're looking at our world, our households that represent the largest portion of our economy, corporations or businesses, and then finally the government. And when you're looking at debt from the point of view of a debt person, the debt issues with corporations were very big in the late 80s, early 90s,
yep.
when we had the SNL crisis and when we had...
Well, they're there now if you're any kind of a commercial property lender.
But commercial property is just a very small segment, Chief, of all the corporate bonds that
right.
are issued, or
right.
all the companies that issue debt. Unlike the late 80s, early 90s, where it really went across the board, these companies have done a good job in managing their balance sheets. The people who are having issues now are individuals and households that are saying, the only way I can afford that house or that new car is to take to put it all on credit, and now they're paying high rates for, to do that. And on the other side is the government doing the exact same thing.
Just, well, that's kind of it's sort of the point I'm trying to make. Then is the junk bonds part was they gave you a little bit more interest, but if more than 1 in 10 would have gone under, you'd have been a loser. And in fact, their default rate was what, like 1 in 30? It wasn't even close to being one. I mean, they did an amazing job at getting the right company, something like you do now. And so right now, I mean, their credit card rates are so high. You're right, but if they lose 1 out of 30 people, I don't think they give a crap. They'd rather not, obviously. But I mean, I think
it's just more prevalent right now. Yeah. That's the thing. It's much more prevalent with individuals. With the household credit is much more at risk than corporate credit, or government credit is at risk too. And I think what's happened recently, like say the better part of this year, is that that has all been masked by what we're seeing in the media that's related to the election. And even when they're talking about the election, very seldom do you hear they're talking about our deficit or issues of debt issues or potential default issues at the government level. Most of it is being talked, you know, there's other issues that are being prioritized. But this issue, I believe, once the election is over, it's going to come to light and it's going to be more focused on the deficit. And there probably will be an event that draws more attention to the deficit.
Well, we got to go to Dash here to a quick break. But all this stuff, Dan, I like to joust with my guys or ladies, because I agree with just about everybody. But you can't just sort of say that. So I'm trying to, okay, what's going to be the catalyst? What do we have to look out for? I mean, yesterday we had a big winner in his GOLD. So we sold our stuff out at like 70 cents that we paid. I think we paid a dime for or something, because he did a time spread. You know, not massive or anything like that, but it was a real nice winner. Now, sure enough, today it's up another 24 cents. I mean, you wonder at some point here, can we continue to tell people there's no inflation when there is? I sense in the last 3 months a real acceleration in inflation. I mean, I don't know if I'm just, except for gasoline, which is coming down. Other than that, everything else to me is on the creep here. I mean, the housing prices, the rental prices in Chicago, you look at any of that stuff, it's going straight up. I mean, the cost of car service, the cost of car repair, God help you. I had the property taxes. Somebody was at our table over in the series the other night. His buddy just called him. We were at the table. He's got my tax bill in Winnetka or someplace. It's up 25% or something. People's insurance costs. Insurance, 20% across the board in some places. I mean, we're not slowing down here.
No, not at all. And it's actually worse in Florida. I mean, we're already seeing, I think Florida is going to be part of the, it's going to be the focus, because I think it's happening there first now, more so than other parts of the country, where people are being impacted by higher HOA costs, higher insurance costs, and higher costs across the board. So the local municipalities are having to charge more for utilities. There's, you know, it's growing so fast, so there's infrastructure growth issues that are being paid for by the people, and it's really forcing a lot of people into large amounts of debt, and even like to the point where they're going to have to leave and move because they can't afford their monthly costs. So I think that's going to spread to other parts of the country as well over time.
Hey, I got three or four of the coolest lines in history to give us a little comic relief that I could beg. You're going to love these, Dan. S&P Futures up 48 and NASDAQ Futures up 313. Yes! And we don't think we have any calls in covering anything today, so we're cheering here today. Now, we might roll our puts up a little, Dan, to make sure we lock some of this in, but as of now, it looks like a pretty nice day for all concerned. Be right back, Stocks and Jacks.
Are you one of the millions of people who suffer with pain? Do you wake up in the morning with stiffness in the lower back or neck? Why are you using medication to cover up the symptoms without treating the actual cause? Painkillers, muscle relaxants, and anti-inflammatories are not the answer. At ChiroMed, physicians are trained to detect the cause of your symptoms and to correct the underlying problem. If you're ready to listen to common sense and do what it takes to make changes in your body that can affect your health for the rest of your life, Give ChiroMed a call and set up a complimentary consultation. They are located in Orland Park and can be reached at 708-403-2727. 20,000 patients over 22 years have been treated at ChiroMed, and over 90% of them have had positive results without medication or expensive surgery. Isn't it time you did something good for your body too? Give ChiroMed a call. 708-403-2727. That's 708-403-2727. Let's get you pain-free and living again.
Well, you don't need $1 million to do nothing, man. Take a look at my cousin. He's broke, don't do
stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now. Right here, right now. Right now.
Hello and welcome to Stocks and Jocks. Time out. Greg Pappas on the board. S&P futures up 47. Nasdaq futures up 308. The catalyst on this, well, at least allegedly, is Micron predicting huge revenues for the next quarter. Straddle was 990. The stock is up 1750. Went through that straddle like dinner like a goose, Greg. Dinner through a goose, sorry. So anyway, we're up all over the place. I can't say anything. It's really down. Chevron, Texaco down because oil's getting whacked. That's the only thing that's down. The only red sign is oil here. We're in Europe. DAX down up 216. Sorry, down. Up 216, 1.1%. FTSE seriously lagging, only up 8%. 8 points. It's 0.1%. CAC around up 116, 1.5%. So bullish over there. Really being led by Asia. Nikkei up 1,055, 2.8%. Hang Seng up 785. That's 4%. Those guys went from under 18,000 to 19,924 in about a week. All it takes is more money. Reserve requirement, lower interest rates. I don't even know how the hell the banks over there even have reserve, but whatever. It sounds good. Shanghai up 104, 3.6%. Yesterday, the Dow was down 293, but you can't even look at the Dow because there's only a few stocks in there just maneuvered all over the place. S&P was down 10, NASDAQ up 7. So a very quiet day other than a couple stocks in the Dow. Bonds up 2 basis points, 3.80. 10-year keeps creeping. Blend down 3 basis points, 2.15. Japan up 2 basis points, 0.83. Oil, like I said, oil, whack, whack, whack. Deck down to 67.86. 180 down to $1.83. Somebody threatened to cut off supply, ran up to 72. Now it's right back down. Brent down to $1.85, 71.61. Natural gas unchanged, 263. Arbob down to 197, down 2 cents. Gold up again, up 17 bucks, 27.01. We've been long gold the whole way. I just wish we were longer. Silver up 69 cents, 32.71, making a run at 33. Copper up 9 cents, 4.58. U.S. dollar pretty much unchanged against the pound. Euro 111. The pound continues to get stronger, almost 134 here. Japan 144.70, and again, you look at the other way, it's 144 yen to the dollar. Swiss franc is up on the day as well. So that would be lower against the dollar. Bitcoin up 1,100 bucks, 64,418. What do you got for us? Traffic, weather, sports. Are you going tonight to see if the Sox lose, Greg? $10?
Not me.
By the way, the cost on Ticketmaster to switch the ticket to yourself is more than the cost of the ticket.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Anyways, let's see. 7:39 here in Chicago. Got 56 degrees outside, sunny to partly cloudy today. High of 74. Phoenix, 82. Record-breaking temps. Excessive heat warning. High of 109. Stay indoors there. Traffic. Oh, let's do our Hurricane Helene. Hurricane strength just upgraded to Category 2. Looking to make landfall probably Thursday night and Friday a.m. That's probably going to land as a 3 or 4. Florida's entire west coast, including Tampa Bay, is at risk of storm surges up to 15 feet. Direct hits are rare in Tallahassee. They say it's going to be extremely destructive. National Hurricane Center forecast.
15 feet, that's like 2.5 times somebody's height.
Yeah, and land forecasts 120 to 125 mile per hour winds and rainfall up to 12 inches. Traffic, inbound Kennedy from Montrose, 46 minutes. Edens from Lake Cook, 74 minutes. Eisenhower from Wolf, 63 minutes. Ryan from 95th is 36 minutes. And the Stevenson from 294 to the Ryan is 48 minutes. Sports. NFL, Cowboys-Giants tonight at 7:15. That's on Prime Video. MLB, Cubs lose at Phillies. That was 6-9. Angels lose at the White Sox. That was 3-4. and Giants lost to Diamondbacks 2-8. That's all I got, Chief.
Did you two gentlemen ever see the kind of detailed, what's the name of the guy who put the wind gauge together, Dan or Greg? Like a detailed wind gauge. It was pretty interesting. Like, you know, 40 miles an hour, even a strong person has trouble walking into the wind. You know, 50 old people fall over, 55 young people fall. I mean, it starts working its way up, and you get to like 60, empty railroad car goes over, 70, full railroad car goes over.
Uh-oh.
You start to get to 120, it's pretty much, I mean, a big building in Chicago, a skyscraper, steel, can withstand that for a while, but they're pretty much designed for 120, aren't they? And you're going to lose all your windows or a lot of the windows. I mean, every 10 miles an hour up, it's almost like a geometric progression, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
It's a...
There's a lot of high-rise in Miami.
Yeah. What I'm saying, the high-rise would be all right, but you wouldn't want to be in one with the flying glass and everything.
Oh. Well, hurricane windows.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to read you a few of these because they're kind of interesting. Remember the name Dan Senator Everett Dirksen way before Greg's time? In order to be a successful politician, one must have gray hair to appear distinguished, wear glasses to appear wise, and have hemorrhoids in order to appear serious at all times.
That's great.
Winston Churchill, fact is the ability to tell someone to go to hell in such a way that they look forward to it. At this point, there's not a name on this one, but God, is this true? Everyone is in favor of free speech. Hardly a day passes without it's being extolled, but someone's idea of it is that they are free to say what they like, but if anybody else says anything back, that is an outrage.
Yeah.
How true is that?
Very true. Absolutely. That's very true.
I think you can say this about the maybe the internet and certainly Twitter.
Sure.
Twitter.
Sure.
When eagles go silent, the parrots begin to jabber.
Yep. Absolutely.
Is there, other than being generally protected here, because we are at, you know, pretty much high stuff in the market, do you see anything in the next? Now, Kenny was on the other day saying that October is generally a crummy month, that this, everybody's going to try and get as high as they can by the end of September because it's the marking period. Kenny's still the New York floor guy.
I'm going to try to get high this weekend.
Yeah.
And we could try to get high. We could all just try to get high. Greg, all you got to do is walk across the expressway and order the truck at night. You get high. What the Supreme Court? Illinois, this is how far we've gone on this, Dan. And I don't want to get off on a crime and punishment discussion. I think the Illinois Supreme Court just ruled in their infinite wisdom that billowing clouds of smoke and huge marijuana smells coming out of a car is no reason to search it.
My concern is just the drivers themselves. I don't know how that it works. I mean, it's very easy with drunk driving, right? You have a breathalyzer, you have a certain level that's considered toxic, and I know there's probably something comparable with pot.
I don't think there is.
I don't know that there is, and that's a that could definitely be. I think it definitely could be a concern, especially in terms of focus and. Just a couple of things I want to mention that I think are important for the listeners. Just seeing how quickly interest rates have come down on the short end, and we had talked. You know, there's certainly the Fed's 50 basis point cut was the impetus for that, but in general, short rates have continued to come down. So the question I've been getting from a lot of people, does it still make sense to buy T-bills? Well, you can buy a two-month T-bill for 4.70, and when the yield goes down, the price of your T-bill goes up. So, and it's the same thing with when you buy a two-year. The two-year is all the way down at 3.5%, 3.58, I think you said earlier. And yes, the short rates will continue to come down. I would not go longer. I think, as we've discussed before, there's a lot of risk with 5, 10, 30-year bonds. But on the short end, we'll continue to see rates come down. That's a given. And how fast that's going to happen, we're not sure. But you can still get 4.70. That's still a good return, relatively speaking. Where we're seeing the shift and where we are moving a little bit. And actually, I heard validation of this on Bloomberg TV this morning, is look at short-term corporate bonds that, as you mentioned the term, Chief, earlier, investment grade. Yeah. In other words, high-quality corporate bonds. And we have a few that we've invested in that are triple B rated. One of them is called Associate Bank Corp. It's high quality. It matures in this January of 2025. And you're getting about 6.25, 6.5. So that's substantially higher than what you're getting on a T-bill. So that's one name, one bond that I think looks attractive. Another is a company called Prospect Capital Corp. Those bonds mature in January of 2026, and you're getting 6.5%. Now, 6.5 doesn't sound like a lot, but when your 2-year is yielding 3.5, yeah, 6.5 looks pretty good for an investment grade, for a high quality bond. And we use the lingo, money good, meaning they have the cash to pay when the interest and principal come due in January of 26, in this case. So that's where we have shifted focus a little, staying on the fixed income side, staying on the bond side, looking for a little more yield. Corporates are offering that right now. We do our homework on these corporate bonds. So people ask, well, how do you know which ones to buy? Well, come to us and we can certainly help you with that. That's what we do all day long. So, and as I mentioned before, municipal bonds still look good. Tax equivalent yield is attractive. Sure, the rates have come down on those as well, but they're still very attractive. Some we're buying some yesterday at 5.25, tax exempt, high quality, AA rated. Not bad to be able to get the tax break. Again, those are not for your IRA. Those are for your individual accounts or maybe a trust account that is taxable.
I'm just going to have to advise, warn, remind the listeners that when you listen to what Dan says, listen very carefully. Because he's
look at, you know, or get a hold of us and ask us to oversee this for you, because this is an area that I've missed opportunity, why everyone's focused on the tech stocks, but we're making a lot of money in bonds right now because interest rates are coming down. This is a very easy time to make money in bonds. In fact, it would be a very hard time not to make money in bonds.
Well, if any of the listeners wants to, you've heard my commercial, if anybody wants to open up a nice account at PTI Pro Direct, which is an IB platform, and you want to shove 90% of that money toward Dan, we can do it in an afternoon. Easily done. But I guess what I'm saying is, what you mentioned, Dan, when Dan mentions a bond and he mentions the maturity, listen to the whole statement, because every word he said is important. Dan, as we've seen, the oddest thing in the last few months, you've seen short-term rates dropping pretty precipitously, faster than the Fed even says they're dropping. Now, if you have something out a couple of years, you just said you actually are making money on that bond. I mean, not a hell of a lot, but the bond's up. Now, the long-term rates have taken this move from the Fed, I think, and have said, well, wow, that's going to cause some inflation. They've done nothing but up. So if you...
Right.
That rate has gone up. So if you had a 10-year or a 20-year bond, that bond's going down. So when Dan says 2 years, don't go out and buy a 10, because he didn't say 10. He said 2.
Right.
So
Or 1 year. Yeah, or even shorter. The shorter, the better, because short bonds do not have what's called interest rate risk.
Yeah.
When interest rates go up, the price of your bond goes down. If you're holding a long-term bond, the price is going to go down much more than if you're holding a one-year bond. A bond with a one-year maturity. Some people, you know, one investment that actually, and I'm not a big fan of CDs, but in this environment, CDs have made sense because we know rates are going down, and if you can lock in 5.25 for a year, that's a good investment. This is one time where CDs do make sense. What I don't like about CDs is that you're locked in. In other words, it's hard to take your money out. In most cases, you pay a penalty to take your money if you need it sooner. But if you have a little bit of money and you want to put it aside and you can get 5% on a one-year CD, then that's a decent investment right now.
Well,
in general, though, I would not recommend CDs.
Well, the difference, if you want to go out a year, and again, it's probably not what Dan and I would say. Say you want to go out a year. If you do it in a CD, you know, you're stuck for a year. Now, the penalties I don't think are that massive, but there are penalties to get out. And now, but if you put the money here, a PTI, and we go to and we say, okay, we're going to go to a treasury. Maybe we're going to get a little less, maybe the same amount. The market drops 40% next week, and you say, the hell with this treasury. I want all in. We could get unload that thing in 10 minutes, and you're probably not going to lose, you know, at all.
Right.
And so you're right back in, not to mention the fact that if you have a treasury in your account, it's 90% marginable right then, or 95. So right. Maybe you can borrow right against it if you wanted to. But, Dan, where would you say with the 10 and 30-year probably going down and the short ones going up, where's the year where your fixed income security didn't move? It's flat. Is it 3 years, 3.5?
Probably around two to three years is where it's going to be relatively flat, where you're not going to have a lot of movement. And in those bonds, you want to make sure you have a high coupon. The interest that when a bond is quoted, it's quoted with a rate. You know, the IBM 5% is due in 2026. So the 5% is the coupon rate that you're guaranteed each year. It's generally paid twice a year, so you get 2.5% in January if it matures in January, and then 2.5% in July. So it's every 6 months that they'll pay interest, and it's half of whatever the coupon rate is, the stated rate. That's your interest. Now your yield to maturity, or your total return on that bond, will be higher than 5% if the price of the bond is less than par or less than 100. The price of the bond is higher, you're buying it at a premium, and then the yield, or the total return, if you will, of that bond till maturity will be lower than 5%. So it's for a lot of people, it's not a very obvious, you have to just accept it as this is just the way bonds work. Price comes down, yield goes up. Yield comes down, price goes up. So when you buy a bond, if you're paying more than 100 for it, you're not going to get the same return as the coupon rate. You're going to get a lower return. You're paying less than 100 for that same 5% coupon, you're going to get more than 5% yield to maturity. You're going to have a greater than 5% annual return if you hold it to maturity.
Dan, I have a question. I've actually had a couple of clients in the last few weeks. These are obviously no names or anything like that, but there's two or three I'm talking to, and two or three are already here. But the this is money, retired people, don't really plan on working again. Now they've got pensions, they got their social, they're okay. So money comes piling out of the 401k plan. Let's put a number on it. Let's say it's $1 million each per. Now this is the whole retirement thing, so it's not like they're zillionaires or anything like that. Let's say it's $1 million, and my first blush, I won't say what my, well, I will, as soon as, I'll make you talk first. Right now, today, now this is not something you want to make a muni because it's a tax-free, it's an IRA. I suggested, and I haven't done it yet, so it could change today with the market up. I suggested maybe first month, let's do least half in a T-bill. I actually said I'm going to talk to Dan, see if there's a really good corporate we could do, maybe a couple hundred grand. And I was thinking some Russell and some maybe still in this the gold miners, because I think if gold stays here, it doesn't have to go up anymore. I think the gold miners still go up. If you tell these guys they're going to get $2,700 an ounce for the next 3 years, I think the gold miners go up. But I've been early on that, but don't trust me, I don't pick stocks. But I want to say, along those lines of percentages, do you think I'm right or wrong?
I think you're right. And I think the one point, we're talking about relationships of what happens, what happens when rates go down, which is what's happening right now. Well, the dollar will generally come down. That's what we've seen. When the dollar comes down, we generally see gold go up. We see silver go up. Gold is, and we've seen that exactly. So the relationship that you learned in Economics 101 is absolutely happening right now. That relationship is a one-for-one relationship. It's happening the way it's supposed to. Oil, on the other hand, is a different animal because there are other factors that come into play with oil. There's OPEC, there are geopolitical risks, there's a supply and demand that's controlled by a group of people, whether it's the Saudis or you know, Venezuelans or Russian. There's a supply and demand that's driven by political and geopolitical issues that is not as that kind of takes away from the traditional economics 101 principles. So you can't look at off, you can't put oil in that category, but you can put gold in that category. You can put the dollar in that category. When rates come down, simple relationship, dollar comes down, gold goes up. And that's the environment we're in. So to say, do we expect gold to continue this trend? I would say yes, because we expect rates to continue to come down. Now, the other thing, Chief, that we do is we track the history of gold and silver, and we look at where they've been. And up until a year ago, silver and gold were looking as good buys, but people weren't focused on them. They were focused on the tech stocks. But we had put money into silver, and it's done quite well over the last year. Gold has done even better. But these we always say it's good to have some exposure to these metals, especially when we can see that they've traded at lower ends of their historic ranges and when we know that interest rates are coming down. So in terms of choosing stocks right now, it's tough. I mean, we've been out there doing that. I have a couple conferences in October to visit CEOs of companies to get some new ideas, but you really have to be selective in here. Unless you want to ride the momentum of the five tech stocks, you have to be selective.
And you got to be careful. Our producer, Greg, who does a lot of research for the show, and sometimes we don't want him talking off. Matter of fact, most of the time. But, Greg, what did you dig up? I don't know if we sent this to you, Dan. In the last how many years, if you look at the stock market through the price of gold, not the dollar, it's unchanged?
It's an interesting comparison that they do.
Well, Dan just said it, though. You drop the value of the dollar, everything else goes up. If you value the market by gold or you value the market by Major League Baseball teams, it hasn't gone anywhere, has it? Right.
So are you saying we should buy Major League Baseball teams?
No, I'm just saying that if everybody looks at everything as a relationship to the dollar, if you think of it differently and look at when all this stuff goes up, it could be, since you're valuing it on the dollar, that the value of the dollar is going down. It doesn't matter so much unless you've got your money in a bank getting paid 0.5% when the inflation rate is really 10%. Then you got a problem, right, Dan?
Yes.
You got a serious problem. I was just going to ask you some last very, very serious question. Is there any catalyst on the horizon you can see where everybody's going to wake up and say some of this stuff's too high? I don't really see it. I mean, I'm sure it'll. We seem to have. It doesn't seem to be wars. It doesn't seem to be anything. Nothing. The government's absolutely convinced they can get away with lying about inflation.
I think the catalyst, Chief, is going to be what happens after the election is out, because I think a lot of the hype for the past year has been only talking about, when you talk about the economy, it's not the way you and I see the economy, not people who've been doing this for their whole careers. They're not looking at things like the deficit. So I think when news creeps up about the deficit, like I said yesterday, the news was out about auto loans, auto loan defaults being at record highs. I saw that, but it was a very quick article. It was a very short, quick article. It wasn't something that was major headlines. When those become major headlines, I think that's going to be an opportunity for people to say, hey, I've made money, time to cut back. My rule of thumb is once you've made money, almost every day, I think we've had the 41st record high in the year 2000 for the S&P in the year 2024 here. That, to me, is the catalyst as an investment manager to not overweight, but if anything, to take some off the table and put it into your strategy and my strategy.
Sort of avoiding the cues here. Should I be? Or are we getting another 10% out of them in 3 weeks and then get out? Or what? I mean,
if you're going to watch it on a daily basis, I would say pay attention. I want to mention one other thing that goes along with what we're saying, and in terms of what people's objectives are. So if you're willing to deal with the volatility and you can weather the daily ups and downs as somebody who's retired or in retirement, then great. But a woman that I met earlier this week had some very interesting insights and really kind of surprised me with really just how spot on she was. And she mentioned two things. And one of the things she mentioned is, you know, her friend's doing day trading and saying, oh yeah, I'm making money. So she was clever enough to be able to make an observation that, yeah, these are younger people we're talking about that have said, oh, hey, I can do this. I don't need help from anyone. I can just go online and make money. So that's one thing. But the other thing is she used the word absolute returns. She goes, I want absolute returns. And it was unusual to hear somebody who's not in our industry use those words. So to describe absolute return is positive returns. It's creating a portfolio or managing a style of investment that only creates positive returns. And that's what you and I do, Chief.
Yep.
We do not have returns that drop below, you know, or drop very far into negative territory. So their focus with a lot of hedge funds, private equity, are to have only absolute returns. Their mission, their goal, their objective is to provide positive returns even in negative environments. So you never have to go into that mode where you're trying to make up for lost money or you invested at the wrong time. Yeah, this market is going up and up and up. Somebody puts money in and then they just happen to put it in at the wrong time. And for the first few weeks, they're seeing it drop into negative territory. Well, if you focus on absolute returns the way we do, then you're only going to see positive growth. Even if we underperform the S&P 500, it's still positive. But then when the market underperforms or on those days when it drops, we still have positive returns. So the concept of absolute return is very important. It's very important for understanding your objectives. And it's also one where you're never having to make up for lost ground.
Well, nothing can screw you more than somebody giving somebody $1 million and 3 months later it's 800,000. So to get back to the million and go from there is boy, oh boy. That's a tough haul.
It's a tougher challenge. It's not a reciprocal relationship. It's not a symmetrical relationship. No. When you lose 10%, you have to make 11% to make it back.
Well, Dan, see you next Thursday, if not sooner. When are you coming this way? California, you're like Marco Polo, for God's sake, these days.
I am. No plans in the very near future, but I am going to be there soon, and I will certainly keep you in touch.
All right, buddy. You take care of yourself. Greg, great job. Good research as you're doing. S&P futures up 47, NASDAQ is up 327. To the sky. To the sky. I'll be back tomorrow. Stocks and Jocks.
That's all, folks.